Hey, welcome to Medical Stuff. My name is Mark. I don't have anything tonight because I am not feeling well, Frankum. And that is Chris. You know what, dude? I'm not feeling well either. Finkson, how you doing,
man? I'm sick.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that it has a positive effect on both of our voices and we end up just being the, yeah, that fell apart quick.
I don't know, but I think your voice isn't going to get any lower. I think your voice is already the lowest possible audible sound or audible frequency. And that it just, yeah, anything lower than that be entirely inaudible.
Should I just croon the entire time in the background gently while you talk?
Well, let's hear you crooning. There we go. Hey, welcome to Medical Stuff. My name is Chris Fakeson. Mark's not here, but his voice is. Today we're going to be doing part two of paralysis. Hopefully we won't make you numb with boredom.
No.
God, that was fucking terrible.
Coming at you in the 3 a.m. hour.
Yeah, so tonight it's part two of paralysis.
Oh, the attack of a paralysis. I would say, I have a feeling that today is going to be a very interesting podcast.
I think so. Because,
you know, the information is cool, but also both you and I are kind of loopy.
We're not our A game. So, although the sad part is we've done episodes before. I think renal system was one of the ones where we both start off with, hey, we're feeling like shit. And we recently got a compliment on exactly that episode. So so maybe this is what we need.
I remember respiratory, we were both coughing and snorting and
we're like,
hey, if you want to hear wheezes, here, let Frankum like breathe into the microphone for a few seconds.
Exactly.
And, you want to hear Ronkai, Chris is going to, put the microphone in his mouth.
Oh, today I had to help another employee get access to a chart, and they said that they had worked with Frank Combe. FRANCOME.
That's actually a product coming out. It's going to be the Frank Combe over.
Oh, there you go. It's basically just a little bit of, never mind.
Okay, so we're going to pick off. Good Lord. We're going to pick off today, Balls Palsy. So today we're going to pick off.
What did you say, Balls Palsy?
Because we're picking off instead of picking up.
Oh, yeah.
So
we're already screwed up.
Continuation of the mispronunciation of basic words. Guillaume Belle. There we go.
Boy. Yeah, Bell's Palsy. Bell's Palsy.
Bell's palsy causes a sudden temporary weakness in your facial muscles.
Right.
So does Irish car bombs on myself.
Causes a lot of weaknesses.
This makes half of your face appear to droop. Your smile is one-sided, and your eye on that side resists closing. No! Close, damn you!
No! It'll eventually do it.
Right.
But.
Well, it's. You just have to bring a. You just have. Never mind. I was going to say you have to fashion your other eyeball as a Death Star and bring it in and threaten to kill Alderaan. And the Resistance obviously folds because that's how the movies go. Anywho, Bell's palsy, also known as facial palsy, which just seems like not putting any effort into the name personally. Can occur at any age. The exact cause is unknown.
We've never had the sentence go like that. The exact cause is known. Totally known. This is the exact cause right here.
They have nailed it years ago.
Normally, if we're ever starting a sentence with the exact cause is, it's never known.
In fact, they're still curious as to why we're talking about it.
Like when Mark and I, when we first started this current remote recording session, Mark asked me how my day was, and I said, well, I start off like that, and that's never followed up, as Mark pointed out, that's never followed up with greatest day ever. It's just not. It's just not. That being said, it was actually a pretty okay day, but still.
Yeah. So the exact cause is unknown, or, depending on where you live, not known. It is believed to be the result of swelling and inflammation of the nerve that controls the muscles on one side of your face. And which cranial nerve is that, Chris?
I'm going to say the facial nerve.
Oh, yeah? Is that an actual cranial nerve?
It is.
Are you making that up?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, come on. I mean, like facial inflammation, it sounds made up. Or facial palsy, it sounds like it's made up if you think about it. So the facial nerve, or it might be a reaction that occurs after a viral infection. I read a report the other day talking about how that we're coming to the point of antibiotics on certain diseases just no longer being effective. We can't make anything strong enough now.
Yeah, and we have a podcast about that exactly.
Mm-hmm. The difference between viral and bacterial infections.
Yeah, and the problem with antibiotics, that's probably for a different podcast. I was about to go off again. Just go listen to that one.
Overuse of antibiotics are creating issues in the long term.
Right.
How about that?
Yeah.
So symptoms of Bell palsy come on suddenly and may include rapid onset of mild weakness to total paralysis on one side of your face, occurring within hours or days. Facial droop and difficulty making facial expressions, such as closing your eye or smiling. Drooling. Pain around the jaw or in behind your ear on the affected side. Increased sensitivity to sound on the affected side. Headache. A decrease in your ability to taste. Changes in the amount of tears and saliva you produce. In rare cases, Bell's palsy can affect nerves on both sides of your face. So I like how they, I got the exact causes unknown, and the heading of the next session is causes.
So
it's gonna be a short section. It's just I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So causes. Nobody knows.
Okay. Yeah. Risk factors. Moving on.
And toast.
Although the exact reason for Bell's palsy isn't clear, is often related to exposure to a viral infection. Viruses that have been linked to Bell's palsy include the viruses that cause cold sores and general herpes, chickenpox and shingles, infectious mononucleosis, Epstein-Barr is the name of that, cytomegalovirus infections, respiratory illness like adenovirus, German measles, rubella. You have to say it with a German accent.
Jawohl.
Jawohl. It's a German. It's a rubella. Mumps or the mumps virus. Again, that seems like it's not really putting much effort into it if you're going to call the mumps virus mumps virus. The flu, the influenza B. And then hand, foot, and mouth disease or Coxsackie virus.
Huh?
Coxsackie virus.
One more time.
Coxsackie virus. Coxsackie virus. Yes, we are 12 years old.
Yes, we are.
Well, you know, considering it's Bell's palsy, they call the thing about calling it Ballsackie virus, but Coxsackie virus, yeah. The nerve that controls your facial muscles passes through a narrow corridor of bone on its way to your face. It's like a little tunnel in the side of your head. It's got a little turnout so people can stop and take pictures.
Well, right. I mean, the scenery there is absolutely fantastic.
You know, there's a little memento board or like information board about the area and the history of it.
Yeah. Number you can call for traffic info. Yeah, exactly.
In Bell's palsy, the nerve becomes inflamed and swollen, usually related to a viral infection. Yes, we get it. Viral infection.
Jesus.
Really hammering on that viral infection. Besides facial muscles, the nerve also... The nerve also affects tears, saliva, taste, and a small bone in the middle of your ear.
The stapes, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
The rabies?
Stapes. Like staple, but stapes.
Like the store?
Exactly. Yep. So risk factors. So Bell's palsy occurs more often in people who are named Mark. That's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Are pregnant, especially during the third trimester, or who are in the first week after giving birth. People who have an upper respiratory infection, like a flu or a cold, and people that have diabetes. So recurrent attacks of Bell's palsy are rare, but in some of these cases, there's a family history of recurrent attacks, suggesting a possible genetic predisposition to Bell's palsy.
Ah, crap, it's fall again. Like every year, every time you come around to like fall solstice.
So there are some complications with Bell's palsy. So a mild case of Bell's palsy normally disappears within about a month. Recovery from a more severe case involving total paralysis can vary. Some of the complications may include irreversible damage to your facial nerves, abnormal growth of nerve fibers, resulting in involuntary contractions of certain muscles when you're trying to move others. For example, when you smile, the eye on the affected side may close. So partial
but yet it resists closing.
What's that?
but yet it resists closing.
Yeah, make up your mind. partial or complete blindness of the eye that won't close due to excessive dryness and scratching of the clear protective covering of the eye, the cornea. So, diagnosis. How is Bell's palsy diagnosed? So, there's no specific test for Bell's palsy. So, your doctor, it's not like a blood test. They can't be like, yes, it's chock full of Bells. That's not how it works. Your doctor will look at your face and ask you to move your facial muscles by closing your eyes, lifting your brow, showing your teeth, and frowning, among other movements. So, other conditions like a stroke or infections, Lyme disease, and tumors can also cause facial muscle weakness that mimic Bell's palsy. This is especially complicated for Mark and I because we often do deal with the acute onset of strokes in the field. That's a good time to call 911. And people with a history of Bell's palsy is a noteworthy history that we will definitely want to know.
Well, I mean, if we see these symptoms, we're going to assume the worst, even with the history.
Absolutely. But it's still an important part of it, too.
Definitely throw it out there.
Yeah. So if the cause of your symptoms isn't clear, your doctor may recommend some other tests, including electromyography, EMG. This test can confirm the presence of nerve damage and determine its severity. An EMG measures the electrical activity of a muscle in response to stimulation and the nature and speed of the conduction of the electrical impulses along that nerve. Image scans, magnetic resonance imaging, an MRI, or computerized tomography, CT, may be needed on occasion to rule out other possible sources of pressure on the facial nerve, like a tumor or a fracture, skull fracture.
Tomography or tomography?
I say tomography. You say tomato, I say tomato. You say tomography, I say tomography. Or no.
Okay.
I say tomography, you say tomography. whenever I read skull fractures, I always think back to that dude we had in the skate park that fractured his skull and like didn't want to go. Because he's also the one guy that I believe had a positive halo sign on a, that like in my entire career, halo sign, sorry to branch off, but you know what you're listening to.
Yeah, really.
Halo sign is when you take a 4x4, it's a little piece of gauze, and you dab blood that's coming out of someone's ear, typically, and you look at it, and if it gets a little yellow ring around it, that ring is caused by cerebral spinal fluid. And I was working with Mark.
That should be inside your head.
Yeah. Cerebral spinal fluid, I should say, get this, around your cerebrum and your spine, not outside of it. But anyway, and I was a pretty green basic. I wasn't super green, but I was new. And I, of course, like this guy, he's laying down, we're holding his C-spine, and I run up there and I want to do this test. And I don't think Mark said anything, but Mark certainly didn't ask for the test to be done because it never turns out positive and it's never going to change. I mean, it's not like we weren't going to make the guy a trauma system entry. He got knocked out and hit his head on concrete.
Because if I remember correctly, he was skating in the wintertime at the time of the morning when the part of the skate park was still covered in ice.
Yeah. And didn't work out for him. And he cracked his skull pretty good. And sure enough, it was positive. The halo sign was positive. And then we took him up and he was a jerk the entire way. We got the opportunity to head back up to the same hospital we took him to. And Mark stopped in there and he told Mark, yeah, I got actually a skull fracture. Yeah.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah, douche. That's why we took you up here. Anyway, so
you're not telling us anything we didn't know on scene, just so you know.
So treatment. Most people with Bell's palsy recover fully, with or without treatment. There's no one-size-fits-all treatment for Bell's palsy, but your doctor may suggest medications or physical therapy to help you speed your recovery. Surgery is rarely an option for Bell's palsy. So, some medications. Take it away, Mark!
Medications. Commonly used medications to treat Bell's palsy include corticosteroids, such as prednisone, and they're anti-inflammatory agents that... or what they're looking for. They're trying to get those nerves to settle down. If they can reduce the swelling of the facial nerve, ooh, you nailed it. Well, you are carrying the show.
Yeah,
so
pretty much.
Now we got two people, the person from the review and Jessica Trout, you know, backed them up on that. So she's probably getting more airplay than she ever really wanted to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's like, good Lord, why did I agree to let him
change? Her next email is going to be like, can you stop using my name, please?
If they can reduce swelling of the facial nerve, it will fit more comfortably within the bony corridor that surrounds it. Corticosteroids may work best if they are started within several days of the onset of symptoms. Antiviral drugs.
Mm.
or viral. The role of antivirals remains unsettled. Antivirals alone have shown no benefit compared with a placebo. Antivirals added to the steroids are possibly beneficial for some people with Bell's palsy, but this is still, there's still a big question mark behind it. It's one of those things that, and unfortunately, I know you and I have talked about this. This is kind of a lot of what goes on in medicine is, well, that should work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because getting things proven isn't, I mean, getting definitive studies to find these things, if they work or they don't work, is an expensive process.
And sometimes there's also some of the things about, like, and this might be a little bit of a tangent, but so for the EMTs and paramedics out there who've been used to giving nitroglycerin, there's actually no study that shows that nitroglycerin does anything more than treat pain. We know that it should help improve the perfusion of the myocardium, but there's no studies to actually support that. Now, there's no studies that support the opposite, to my knowledge, either. That it doesn't help or does worse. But basically, us giving nitroglycerin is based off that we know it impacts pain and that we know how it works. And so, in theory, it should.
Well, it impacts pain, so surely it's impacting the problem, which is the lack of blood to a certain area of your heart.
Right.
And so, since the pain goes down, well, then we should be by, you know, I guess almost like a transitive property. We got rid of the pain. It should mean that you're getting more blood to that part of your heart.
Right. Exactly. But we're not actually 100% certain that that's what happens. We just know that should be what happens. It's the only mechanism we can think of that it would impact the vein. So we assume that it's working. Anyway, tangent over, but I just want to throw that out there.
Right. However, despite this, Valtrex or valcyclovir is sometimes given in combination with the prednisone in the people with severe facial palsy. Physical therapy. Paralyzed muscles can shrink and shorten, called atrophying, and cause permanent contractures, which is where the muscles just can't come back from it. Physical therapists can teach you how to massage and exercise your facial muscles to help prevent this from occurring. I just see some guy at the gym working out his facial muscles to, you know, help with the facial palsy.
Okay. In all fairness, though,
has a piercing through his cheek that he hangs weights on so he can work out the muscles.
If you want to have a good time, just Google call Chris Fink. No, sure. Just Google extreme eating, like the competitive eating workouts. They do stuff like that where they work out neck muscles and jaw muscles and those kind of things. So,
wow.
Yeah. So you and I laugh, but that's a thing.
Have you seen the one of the lady from Portland? Or she was in Portland at a steakhouse and she puts down like a 96 ounce steak in like 3.5 minutes.
Jesus. No, I haven't. Yeah. But I mean, bravo.
Yeah. Yeah. She's done a bunch of them, but that was the one that really caught my attention. She did it here in Portland. And I mean, she's not even really chewing the steak at all. It was like less than half the amount of time of the previous record.
This is going to sound weird, impressive, man, but like, I just want to know what that looks like coming out. Like, if you're not chewing the food, like,
right.
Like, okay, well, not coming out, but body, once it's out. I don't need to see the process, but like, what does that look like?
I was going to say, there's certain websites you can actually go to.
I know. And that's what I started thinking of. So,
in the past, surgery. We've done physical therapy, little facial muscles, you know. In the past, decompression surgery was used to relieve the pressure on the facial nerve by opening the bony passage that the nerve passes through. But today, decompression surgery isn't recommended. Facial nerve injury and permanent hearing loss are possible risks associated with the surgery. So your distinct possibility, you're not going to make anything better. Rarely, plastic surgery may be needed to correct lasting facial nerve problems. So, yeah. Excuse me.
So, I think this next one, this is probably a form of paralysis. This is probably what comes to mind when most people think paralysis.
Right. And
that's going to be the traumatic spinal cord injury.
Speaking of spinal cord injuries, you see that quarterback get hit in the head with his own helmet this weekend?
Yeah, I did. That was Miles was the guy that hit him.
Right.
And God, what was the name of that quarterback?
I don't know.
I don't remember either. But yeah.
I have a hard time. I know it's the Steelers and the Browns.
Yeah. And he got hit. Like, it's a good solid hit.
Oh, yeah.
That was crazy. And then the fight that happened afterwards, the one guy punching him, kicking him in the head.
Right.
That is nuts.
So, Anyway, so spinal cord. If anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, Google Steelers Browns fight.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you'll see it. So spinal cord injury, damage to any part of the spinal cord or nerves at the end of the spinal canal, the caudae equina.
Cauda equina. Because it is actually, so fun story. Do you know why it's called equina?
Looks like a horse.
Looks like a horse's tail.
Oh.
And cauda is referenced to caudal, as in like towards, they'll put an L at the end of that word of C-A-U-D-A-L. And so if like you think you hold terms, something and caress it? What's that?
Like when you hold something and caress it, you caudal it?
Pretty close. but no, like as, you know, like caudally as in kind of like the anatomical directional term.
Sure.
Anyway.
I've never heard of caudally before, so.
Oh. Well, there you go. Yeah. So
you could be making it up. I don't know.
So yeah, caudal means kind of towards the back or towards the butt. And equina is because it looks like a horse's tail if you look at the way the nerves are splayed out. So it's cauda equina.
Oh, okay.
The weird random shit that comes back from paramedic school. I won't remember completely relevant stuff later on, but that one I got.
We'll get done and you'll forget why you went down to the kitchen, but yet cauda equina, you nail.
Yeah. And like we had one episode where I'm like, that stands for Turkish saddle. And it's just like, who cares?
Yeah. When has that ever benefited you in your job? When has that been like, but doc, that's called the Turkish saddle. And they're like, by Jove, that's it. That's how we'll fix this person.
Yeah. All the time. Well, but I do. But the problem is sometimes I do say shit.
You
had
a dollar for every time Turkish saddles, you know, saved a life.
Oh, God. Now I know the shape.
Anyway, spinal cord injuries often cause permanent damages in strength, sensation, and or body functions below the site of injury. So what is it, like T5 or 6? It is right at your nipple line?
Yeah.
And if it happens there, you'll be a paraplegic. And then if it's farther up than that, it can actually, you can end up being a quadriplegic like Christopher Reeve.
Yeah.
Yeah, he fell off his horse.
He did.
His cauda equina was broken when he fell off his equina.
He, very true. And he's dead now.
Does he die?
Yeah, he died. He got septic and died from a massive infection of bed sores.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
Because that's suspicious in my mind.
That was years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Probably back before I stopped sniffing glue.
Right. That was, let me die.
But, I mean, somebody dying of infection from bed sores is just somebody not doing their job.
Well, I don't know. I don't, because I would think so, but I think this is a guy who is wealthy enough. So yeah, he died in 2004, about 15 years ago.
Huh.
Yeah. So now I could be wrong about what he died from, but it could all, I mean, it could have been that he got a bed sore, which became a larger infection that went unnoticed.
Right.
You know, there are different ways that it can happen. But.
Treated for infected pressure ulcer. So it sounds like it was one that was causing sepsis.
Yeah.
And this is not the first time he'd had it. So he probably had a very weakened immune system. And he went into cardiac arrest after receiving an antibiotic. There was a, growing up, my parents used to listen to a comedian named Jasper Carrot, and he would, part of his routine was about people from Bristol, and they're speaking with a Bristol accent, and that was, you had to take your antibiotics for that. Sandrol, if that dog bites you, I'll smack you, Sandrol. This is a, talking about weird shit you remember from earlier in your life.
Right.
I remember a Jasper Carrot routine, but I forgot where I, like, you know,
put my keys. If you had a cranial nerve earlier.
Like. Exactly. 15 days after his birthday at the age of 52.
Boy, happy birthday to not him. Okay, moving on. That's so, just got bad.
If you've recently experienced a spinal cord injury, it might seem like every aspect of your life has been affected, and it probably is. You might feel the effects of your injury mentally, emotionally, and socially. So I can't remember how in depth I went into this, but
we're going to find out. Mm-hmm. So symptoms.
So Nail it, Chris. Bring it on with symptoms. Give me some symptoms, man. Give me some. I don't want signs. I want symptoms.
You got it. I don't know why I couldn't follow that one smoothly. sure, Mark. I don't know. So your ability to control your limbs after spinal cord injury depends on two factors. So the place of the injury along your spinal cord and the severity of the injury to the spinal cord. So the lowest normal part of your spinal cord is referred to as the neurological level of your injury. The severity of the injury is often called the completeness and is classified as either the following. Complete, if all feeling, sensory, and all ability to control movement, motor, are lost below the spinal cord injury, then your injury is called complete. Incomplete, if you have some motory or sensory function below the affected area, then your injury is called incomplete. And there are varying degrees of an incomplete injury. Additionally, paralysis from a spinal cord injury may be referred to as tetraplegia, also known as quadriplegia. This means that your arms, hands, trunk, legs, and pelvic organs are all affected by your spinal cord injury. Paraplegia. This paralysis affects all or part of the trunk, legs, and pelvic organs. So your arms are still working, but everything else remains affected. So
I know we're talking about TBIs or traumatic, or I'm sorry, talking about traumatic spinal injuries, but there's another plegia, which is hemiplegia, which we generally see with strokes.
Mm-hmm. That would be one side or the other.
Right. You have right-sided hemiplegia. And I believe that can be also a complete or incomplete type of paraplegia.
So, oh, did I know that?
Well, you may have some function. And then I've had patients that are just, well, you've had them too. They're just completely floppy on that side.
Oh, yeah, true. Versus the people who are just weakened on one side. Yeah.
Sorry. I'm a little digression here talking about, I was working an event at a standby. And we had a guy who was an LVAD patient, all right? So we brought him back to our med tech room at a venue. We got a specific room that we used as the medical room. And we brought him back. And on the way back, I'd kind of talked to him. And he said, look, I just overexerted myself. I don't need to go to the hospital. I just need to sit for a few minutes and cool down. And my partner had fallen behind, and we get back to the room, and I tell my partner, I said, just so you know, he's an LVAD patient. He goes, okay. And he comes over and tries to check for a pulse, which you're not going to find on an LVAD patient because it's you're right. And so the patient went, and I went, no. Let's let him work as we, yeah.
So really quick, if you guys don't know, an LVAD is a left ventricular assist device. It's basically a machine that pumps.
But as opposed to your heart, pumps and pulses, this is a continuous flow. And so you're not going to feel a pulse because you have that pulsation. But yeah, he went to say something to my partner and I was like, uh-uh. Let's let him figure this one out. Let's watch the wheels turn here for a few seconds. And it was funny because he's like looking all up and down the arm, and he kind of looked at me and he saw a smile on my face, and I think that's when the gears started engaging. He's like, oh yeah,
Mark's fucking with me.
But how is he fucking with me? So anyway, little digression story that popped into my head that has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about today, so you're welcome. You see your health. Oh, go ahead, you're up, you're doing this. It's all Chris.
Am I? Oh,
okay. That's a good point. Do you actually have the spotlight on you now? Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I actually literally do. There is just a desk lamp, and it's pointed right at my keyboard, which is kind of on me. But anyway.
Can you actually see your name in lights?
So,
okay.
Yeah, pretty much. So your healthcare team will perform a series of tests to determine the neurological level and completeness of your injury. So they will determine the tetraplegia versus paraplegia and, of course, the completeness. So spinal cord injuries of any kind may result in one or more of the following signs and symptoms: loss of movement, loss or altered sensation, including the ability to feel hot, cold, and touch, a loss of bowel or bladder control, exaggerated reflex activities or spasms, changes in sexual function, sexual sensitivity, and fertility, pain or an intense stinging sensation caused by damage to the nerve fibers in your spinal cord. Difficulty breathing, coughing, or clearing secretions from your lungs can also be a difficult problem. In fact, you will see it's not uncommon to have patients who have tetraplegia or quadriplegia to have trachs. Basically, it's an airway through your
throat.
Yeah. For this reason. Yeah.
Which is the bony, and, not bony, but hard prominence on the front of your throat. Some people might refer to it as an Adam's apple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, be just below that is where it comes out. So, emergency signs and symptoms. Emergency signs and symptoms of a spinal cord injury after an accident may include extreme back pain or pressure in your neck, head, or back, weakness in coordination or paralysis in any part of your body, numbness, tingling, or loss of sensation in your hands, fingers, feet, or toes, loss of bladder or bowel control, difficulty with balance and walking, impaired breathing after an injury, an oddly positioned or twisted neck or back.
Okay. So for many, 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 and three more many years.
Wait, wait, how many?
Many, 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 many.
And toast.
We were very, very sensitive to spinal cord injuries. Mm-hmm. Any sort of trauma that involves falling or a car accident or anything, people were put on a spine board.
Yeah.
Where I started in a different state that I won't mention at this time.
Oklahoma.
Even if the patient, like, we would go to car wrecks and the patient has been out walking around and they're sitting in a different car, family members, cop car. If they wanted to go to the hospital, we would then have to use our Kendrick extrication device to get them out of that car and onto a spine board.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Now, the reason being was we were very concerned about causing a worsening to any potential spinal cord injury. Thankfully, within the last 10 years or so, there have been studies and post studies, like not posthumous, but retrospective would be the word I'm looking for, studies of, yeah, what really are the chances of this in most circumstances? You know, if you get into a car wreck where you can walk around afterwards without any discomfort, what are the chances you damage your spinal cord? You know, and right. So it is really going out of vogue to board and collar everybody for any reason. Now, there are still potentials. You know, if you trip and fall on the sidewalk anymore, you're probably not going to get board and collared.
No.
And board and collar means a long spine board with a C collar, a cervical collar around your neck. If you trip and fall off the second floor of your second story of your house, we're probably going to board and collar you because there's a mechanism there that is worthy of note.
We board and collar a guy the other day who was he's up about six steps, and he was coming, and it's kind of like his steps went up six steps, had a landing, and then turned, and he was coming down, and he slipped, and he fell on his back, and basically bounced on his back all the way down every single step,
right,
and then get to the ground. That guy got a backboard. Right. Now, one of the reasons that they did start moving away from backboards is because a lot of the backboards out there have no contour to them, and in and of themselves can cause spinal injury because your back is not flat. Right. It's not straight. It makes kind of an S curve.
Essentially and a fancy, expensive piece of plywood.
Yeah.
Made and out we of plastic.
Putting people... Good?
No, I just said made out of plastic.
Oh, gotcha. Plywood made out of plastic. Yeah. Plastic wood. Ply plastic. But anyway, so yeah, and so putting people flat on that may have not been the best idea. Nowadays, at least at the agency Mark and I work with, we still have the flat plastic board, but we put something called a back raft on there, which is just an air mattress that inflates and fills those gaps. Before that, the training was to, when you put someone on a backboard, you're supposed to pad the voids is how they worded that in class. But the problem with that works great when you're padding voids on a 20-year-old male EMT student mm-hmm. who actually has visible voids. But anybody who has any sort of extra padding of their own or weight, it's going to be difficult to see or get under there.
Right.
Or if there's clothing in the way, those kind of things. So trying to pad in between those voids after you put someone onto the backboard isn't...
Right.
Easy or well, in some cases not practical.
The reason they found that there were problems was one of the reasons we would board and collar somebody who fell would be because they're elderly and they're not as flexible. So they have an increased chance right. of doing spinal cord damage. Well, one of the problems they found is, you know, we were so concerned about the spinal cord that, you know, these patients were laying on these boards for, you know, an hour or greater. Mm-hmm. Well, what was happening during that time was they were starting to have, so you get pressure points. We just talked about that with pressure sores with Christopher Reeve. And that's where you lay on a part, or lay somewhere for too long and you get decreased blood flow to that area and it starts causing an ulcer. And so, yeah, we protected their spine, but we caused ulcerations in these elderly patients.
Right. And we just talked about how an ulcer killed Christopher Reeves because it got infected.
Right.
And so these ulcers, and the problem is these ulcer, these wounds, they're very hard to treat. Mm-hmm. They are very tricky to treat. Some people end up on something called a wound vac to get them healed, which is basically a vacuum that helps keep necrotic tissue from building up. And it's just, they can be nightmares to treat.
Well,
so they are very serious.
If it's on a butt, they can't sit on that. They have to lay down constantly. So these patients will have to be in bed for months sometimes
where they might get other pressure ulcers.
Right. And so, I mean, we now, do we still use boards? Yes, we do, but only in limited capacity when there's a distinct reason to. One person, you're talking about your guy who fell down the stairs.
Yeah.
I had a lady who only fell down about four or five stairs, but she was older. They were cement stairs out in front of her house. And one of the reasons we do continue to board somebody in these circumstances is she had a humerus fracture. So she did enough damage to break a fairly large bone in her body. So let's assume that she did enough damage to maybe damage her spine.
Well, the other thing too is, so this is actually, and I'll go, I'll hit this up and then we can move on here. But one of the things, because this is related, we are talking spinal cord damage and we are paramedics and this is how we treat it. One of the things that Mark also brings up here is, yeah, you have that large fracture, but it's also, you'll have pain. That's a distracting injury. So interesting case, male driving his car, falls asleep, goes off the road, rolls his car a few times, is just screaming and positive that he broke his leg. Just positive. Complains of zero back pain. Zero. Turns out his leg is not broken. His back is fractured. And it's not fractured cleanly. It's kind of messed up. So it's putting pressure on one side of the nerves stemming from the spinal cord, creating severe leg pain. He is convinced his leg is broken. Had the mechanism to break it. The responders on scene presumed it was broken and even applied a traction splint.
Oof.
Yep. Which didn't help. And they took an x-ray of the guy's leg and it's clean.
Yeah.
All he had was a back fracture.
Well, so that is why the nerve that went to that part of his leg was what was being affected.
Yeah, exactly. And it was right from where it was stemming from the spinal cord. Yeah. So that is why we have to be so careful with these distracting injuries.
But the last thing, the reason I brought this up is I saw a thing just today that in the advanced National Registry testing for advanced, and I'm assuming others, this one specifically mentioned advanced, they're taking out the spine board station.
Really?
Mm-hmm. At National Registry level.
Wow.
So they're just taking out that and they're not replacing it with anything.
Huh.
Yeah. Which is, as always in these situations, having been an instructor, great. I'm right in the middle of a class where I have to teach it.
Yeah.
Should I keep focusing on that? Is it going to be in the next testing? And, you know, in EMS, one of the things we're really good about in EMS is communicating these issues. And, you know, there's always a very clear path to follow. I don't know if y'all pick up on the sarcasm in that statement, but there we are.
I picked up on it so much that I fell backwards.
There you go. You pulled the back muscle.
Anyway, so when do you see a doctor in regards to traumatic spinal injury? So anyone who experiences significant trauma to your head or neck, you should seek immediate medical evaluation for the possibility of a spinal injury. In fact, it's safest to assume that trauma victims have a spinal injury until proven otherwise. So we did talk about some caveats to that. Mm-hmm. But any serious spinal injury isn't always immediately obvious, like we just talked about. If it isn't recognized, a more severe injury could occur. Numbness or paralysis may occur immediately or come on gradually as bleeding or swelling occurs around the spinal cord. The time between injury and treatment can be critical in determining the extent and severity of complications and the possible extent of expected recovery. So, damage to nerve fibers. Mark?
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. Whether the cause is traumatic or non-traumatic.
I don't know why I just found that so damn funny.
It's because I'm a comedic genius.
Yes, you absolutely are.
My daughter agrees with that too. That noise you hear is my daughter listening to this podcast and screaming at the top of her lungs. So, which is also a joke because she doesn't listen to the podcast. So, and she likes to push it in my face every chance she gets. Whether the cause is traumatic or non-traumatic, the damage effects of to the nerve and nerve fibers passing through the area of the injury may impair part or all of your corresponding muscles and nerves below the injury site. A chest or thoracic, a lower back or lumbar injury can also can affect your torso, legs, bowel, bladder control, and sexual function. Neck or cervical injury affects the same areas in addition to affecting the movement of your arms and possibly your ability to breathe. So common causes of spinal injuries. The most common cause of spinal injuries in the United States are people with a beard saying, watch this.
I can see that.
Yeah. Or you don't have a hair on your ass if you don't.
So by that logic, I should be paralyzed.
Which was a phrase I may have used to entice Chris to tempt things that he maybe not should have, you know. In theory, that's the rumor. Motor vehicle accidents.
Unsubstantiated.
Unsubstantiated, that's right. Motor vehicle accidents. Auto and motorcycle accidents are the leading cause of spinal cord injuries, accounting for almost half of the new spinal cord injuries each year. That being said, by the new standards, we don't necessarily board and collar all motor vehicle accidents patients, because we look at the severity of the accident and what went on. Falls. A spinal cord injury after 65 is most often caused by a fall. I really want to point out to my mom this section because I've been talking to her about using her cane more. And other than to hit me with it and tell me to be quiet about it, she really seems resistant to that. So,
Mom!
Use your cane! Thwack! Leave me alone, boy! You know.
That really hurts.
No, just like around the house. She's like, well, no, because I walk by things, I can catch myself. Yeah, that's what they tell me all the time on scene too, Mom.
Yeah.
So overall, falls cause about 31% of spinal cord injuries. Acts of violence. Over 13% of spinal cord injuries are a result from violent encounters, most commonly involving gunshot wounds. Knife wounds are common, but it's got to be much more of a specific wound, you know. Sports and recreation injuries. Athletic activities such as impact sports, diving in shallow water, caused up to about 10% of spinal cord injuries. This was, I'm going to say popular in a way that it happened quite a bit while I was lived in Oklahoma, just because people would jump off bridges into rivers and not realize that there was a tree right below the level of the water.
Whoops.
Yeah. So, or they knew there was a tree there, but they didn't factor into the fact that it's the end of summer and the level of the river is way down. That also happened.
I also think people put a lot of faith in water to break their fall more than it really does.
Right. It slows you down.
Yeah, it does. It sure does.
Yeah. But even if you hit wrong, it can do a lot of damage. And then alcohol. Alcohol is a factor in about 25% of spinal cord injuries in some form or fashion.
I would say it's alcohol mixed with any and all of those other things talked about.
So I like this next one. Risk factors. Although spinal cord injuries are usually the result of an accident and can happen to anyone, certain factors may predispose you to a higher risk of sustaining a spinal cord injury, including being male. And, you know, I think Chris will back me up on this. Sometimes we're willing to try stupid shit.
You know, I think... Yeah. Nothing to add. That's it. That's
you know, so spinal cord injuries are affect a disproportionate number of men. In fact, females account for only about, Chris, don't look at it. What number do you think?
I'm going to say 17%.
20%.
Oh, hey, that was a legit guess on my part. It wasn't too bad. It wasn't too far
off. Spinal cord injuries in the United States. So 80% of them are male. Now, being between the age of 16 and 30. that tracks, you know.
Yeah, this whole thing makes sense.
Right. You're most likely to suffer a traumatic injury, a spinal cord injury, if you're between the ages of 16 and 30. The average age at time of injury, that doesn't seem right.
What?
Well, it says the average age at time of injury is 43 years. Oh, it's being pulled down by the fact that the numbers are greater between 16 and 30 as opposed to like elderly people that fall and car wrecks and everything like that. Because next one, being older than 65.
There you go.
falls cause most injuries in older adults. Then here's a shocker, and it kind of loops back into the first two, engaging in risky behavior. Diving in too shallow water, playing sports without wearing the proper safety gear, or taking proper precautions can lead to spinal cord injuries. Motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of spinal cord injuries in the patients people under 65. And then having a joint or bone disorder, a relatively minor injury can cause a spinal cord injury if you have another disorder that affects your bones or joints, such as arthritis, osteoporosis. And then also, we spoke about in one episode, Marfan syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
So, diagnosis.
Hit in spine, can't move well. Diagnosed with spinal cord injury.
There you go. In the emergency room, a doctor may be able to rule out a spinal cord injury by careful inspection. I imagine like a Sherlock Holmes hat on.
As opposed to just careless, haphazard.
Right. What the hell? No, I imagine they have to like put on a Sherlock Holmes hat and like use a magnifying glass and... Yeah.
They're sitting there like they have to page anyone named Watson, please. We right. can't do this without someone named Watson.
The biggest change in the last 20 years is they can no longer smoke the pipe. It has to be a bubble pipe. careful inspection and examination. And testing for sensory function and movement, and by asking someone to some questions about the accident. So exactly how high up was the bridge? Right. But if the injured person complains of neck pain, isn't fully awake, or has obvious signs of weakness and neurological injury, emergency diagnostic tests may be needed. These include x-rays. Medical personnel typically order these tests on people who are suspected of having a spinal cord injury after trauma. X-rays can reveal vertebral or spinal column problems, tumors, fractures, and degenerative changes in the spine.
Degenerate.
Hey, my mom has a degenerative change in her spine.
Well, and look at her son. Yeah, a degenerate.
Yeah, he is a degenerate. Anyway. She would not argue with you on that. CT scans or computerized tomography or tomography. Guillain-Barré. So if you didn't listen to the first paralysis episode and you have no idea why I keep saying that, you need to go back and listen to the first one.
Indeed.
A CT scan may provide a better look at abnormalities as seen on an x-ray. The scan uses computers to form a series of cross-sections of the image that can define bone, disc, or other problems. So it would be kind of like imagine each image is a piece of paper, and you can go up and down between those pieces of paper so you can actually see. An x-ray is like a full-on, like looking at a painting, and then a CT is like looking at it from the side or from the top or whatever, and multiple layers.
I think one way that someone wants, if you're familiar with a deli slicer, and basically what a deli slicer is you have, let's say, just a big chunk of meat. And a deli slicer just comes up and takes off shavings of that meat, one mm-hmm. shave, one layer at a time as you push it through. If you took the human body and put it through a deli slicer, that's essentially what this makes.
Real quick, don't.
Yeah, don't. Yeah, no. We're not saying that. Right. But I am saying, you know, I don't know, maybe just choose your delis carefully. I don't know. Well, let's just put it this way. Sweeney Todd's Delicatessen is not where you should be getting your sandwiches.
MRI or magnetic resonance imaging.
Okay, I'm just going to put out that was a highbrow reference back there, and no one really seemed to acknowledge that. That's one of the smartest references I've made in a while.
Sweeney Todd?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people got it. I got it.
If you got it, you too are pretty smart. And if you didn't, you're also smart, just in a different way.
You're special smart. Or you just haven't seen the play Sweeney. What the hell was it from? Is the name of it Sweeney Todd? It's not, though, is it?
So Sweeney Todd is the... I don't think the play is called Sweeney Todd. I think Sweeney Todd is the character. And then they did a remake. Tim Burton and Johnny Depp made a remake called Sweeney Todd. But the original play, I believe, is called something else.
Interesting.
We're Googling, aren't we?
We are. Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Never mind. It is called Sweeney Todd.
It was. That's the whole thing. The demon barber of Fleet Street. Musical by Christopher Bond and Patrick Quentin. And then the 2007 film is called Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, with Alan Rickman. Another person who has passed on that I really enjoyed a lot of his movies and entertainment.
Yeah, gosh, he was great. He was. Harry, but everything he did, Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Oh, God, like he was Hans in Die Hard.
Yes, Hans Gruber. He was also in, did you ever see Galaxy Quest?
I did see Galaxy Quest, and that was such a good movie. It really we got to move on, though. This is a long episode, and so, not a lot of it's on topic.
we can't wax poetic about Alan Rickman. Anyway, MRI. MRI uses a strong magnetic field and radio waves. Come in, body. How's it going in there? It's a radio wave. To produce computer-generated images, the test is very helpful for looking at the spinal cord and identifying herniated discs, blood clots, and other masses that may be compressing the spinal cord. A few days after the injury, when some of the swelling may have subsided, your doctor will conduct a more comprehensive neurological exam to determine the level and completeness of your injury. So what can happen is you can take a shock to the spine, and it can cause the spinal cord to swell, and you'll get these symptoms, and then maybe, hopefully within a couple of days when the swelling goes down, or a week or so, you'll get return of that sensation. So, this involves testing your muscle strength and your ability to sense light touch and pinprick sensations. So, emergency actions. It's an emergency.
Boom.
Should we do the emergency tones?
God, I'm so yawny today. Sorry.
Urgent medical attention is critical to minimize the effects of any head or neck trauma. Therefore, treatment for spinal cord injury often begins at the scene of the accident. Emergency personnel typically immobilize the spine as gently and quickly as possible using a rigid neck collar and a rigid carrying board, which we've talked about. Again, we're looking at more of the mechanism these days than they used to. Before, it was just like, when in doubt, board them out.
Yeah.
So in the emergency room, doctors focus on maintaining your ability to breathe, preventing shock, immobilizing your neck to prevent further spinal cord damage. And they're even these days, will get you off that actual long board and onto something that decreases those ulcerations or those pressure points.
I will tell you, one of the things, like right when we go into the ER, the very first thing they will do is determine the necessity of that board and collar. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's become a high priority.
Yeah.
And avoiding possible complications such as stool or urine retention, respiratory or cardiovascular difficulty, and the formation of deep vein clots in the extremities.
Right. When you can't move, because your veins actually rely on muscle movement to push blood back up and return to your heart. So if you're not moving as much, blood will pool and cause clots.
Yeah. If you do have a spinal cord injury, you'll usually be admitted to intensive care unit for treatment. You may be transferred to a regional spine center that has a team of neurosurgeons, orthopedic surgeons, spinal cord medicine specialists, psychologists, because it does affect you emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Nurses, and a whole selection of new spines for you to choose from.
Exactly. Nurses, therapists, and social workers with expertise in spinal cord injuries. So, medications, Chris, lay it on me. Lay it thick.
Boom. So, IV methylprednisone, or Solu-Medrol, has been used as a treatment option for acute spinal cord injury in the past. Okay, I have one tangent I have to do about Solu-Medrol. We used to carry Solu-Medrol on the ambulances. We don't anymore. We've since replaced it with dexamethasone. But now, we didn't give it for spinal injuries. We gave it for breathing problems. But one of the things I loved about it is it came in a container that was two parts. It was one part the medication, which was a powder, and the other part was a liquid, because it couldn't be stored in its liquid form. You had to combine it right before you gave it.
And this isn't the only medication that we do that with.
Right. But this was the only medication where it came in this cool container that you would basically put it between your fingers and push, and it would make this so satisfying pop sound as the two sides push together. And it wasn't given a lot. I wouldn't say rarely, but it wasn't a common medication. And I just remember like being a paramedic and looking for the opportunities to either find an expired one that had to be thrown away anyway, or actually use it just because I love that. I gave it to patients that didn't even need it, Mark. I'm joking. I didn't do that. But anyway.
So I'll be broadcasting by myself probably from here on out.
Yeah, I'm going to jail now.
Until we can set up the remote in jail. So I do know what you're talking about. Yeah. That pop that you felt. Yeah.
Okay. Little hourglass thing that you push together.
Yeah.
So anyway, So, solumedrol, but recent research has actually shown that the potential side effects like blood clots, pneumonia, from using this medication outweigh those benefits. So, because of this, methylprednisone, solumedrol, is no longer recommended for routine use after a spinal cord injury. Immobilization.
No,
You may need traction to stabilize your spine. So, to bring the spine into proper alignment or both. In some cases, a rigid neck collar may work. A special bed may also help immobilize your body. Surgery. Often, surgery is necessary to remove fragments of bones, foreign objects, herniated discs, or fractured vertebrae that appear to be compressing the spine. Surgery may also be needed to stabilize the spine to prevent further pain or deformity. Experimental treatments. Scientists are trying to figure out ways to stop cell death, control inflammation, and promote nerve regeneration. For example, doctors may lower the body temperature significantly, a condition known as hypothermia, for 24 to 48 hours to help prevent damaging inflammation. Ask your doctor about the availability of such treatments.
They're actually using hypothermic treatment for a number of different things, CVAs and post-arrest patients.
Nice.
Well, the whole point behind it is to slow the functions down in the body to the point that it doesn't do as much damage. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I tell people around that cell death is actually a process that the cells have to go through. Mm-hmm. And when you make things cold, it slows the process down. So there are some new technologies out there. So inventive medical devices can help people with a spinal cord injury become more independent and more mobile. That's one of the things you got to keep in mind. When someone can't walk or use their arms, they lose their independence. And independence is something we take for granted very, very often in our adult lives. And that can be something that a lot of people really strive for the rest of their lives after they get a spinal cord injury. So some devices may restore function. These include modern wheelchairs. Improved lighter weight wheelchairs are making people with spinal cord injuries more mobile and more comfortable. For some, an electric wheelchair may be needed. Some wheelchairs can even climb stairs, travel over rough terrain, and elevate a seated passenger to eye level to reach high places without help.
Have you seen those? The wheelchairs that like
can no, go up and I haven't.
It? Yeah, they can. So they have a gyroscope in them or a gyroscope.
Is it pronounced Euro?
Euroscope. No, that's a device that helps you get to a Euro place, to a Greek place to get some sandwiches.
It just helps you see it from a distance, actually.
Exactly. No, they will actually use a gyroscope and it'll actually stand up the wheels. Instead of having four wheels on the ground, you'll have two wheels on the ground, and it raises the person up to the point where they're at normal walking height.
Wow.
And then they can also climb a flight of stairs on it.
That is nuts.
Yeah. And I saw one guy, he actually just had tracks, like tank tracks, on his wheelchair.
That is awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, so computer adaptations. For someone who has limited hand function, computers can be very powerful tools, but they could be difficult to operate. Think about a keyboard and a mouse. Computer adaptations range from simple to complex, such as key guards or voice recognition, which almost all of our phones have now. Mm-hmm. Electronic aids to daily living. So essentially any device that uses electricity can be controlled with an electronic aid for daily living. Devices can be turned on or off by switch or voice controlled and computer based remotes. Electrical stimulation devices. So these sophisticated devices use electrical stimulation to produce actions. They're often called functional electrical stimulation systems, and they use electrical stimulators to control arm and leg muscles to allow people with spinal cord injuries to stand, walk, reach, and grip.
If you get a chance to Google this, it is fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Technology is pretty bananas.
Because they're getting to the point where they can actually almost integrate it with your brain. And so you can actually just think, and this will take over. It gets around the injured part of the spine.
Wow.
Yeah. They're not quite there yet. Last I checked, they're not quite there yet, but they're getting pretty friggin' close. So get ready for Armageddon.
Right. So robot gait training. Now, this is emerging technology. It's used for retraining walking ability after a spinal cord injury. So, sleep paralysis.
I want to put this one in here because it's not as commonly known, but from everything I read, there's still a little bit of controversy about this, but it's becoming a much more accepted concept. And there's a lot of times people that are affected by this may not know what's going on. So, go ahead.
Oh, I thought you were, okay.
Cool. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. I can.
All right, knock it out.
Sleep paralysis is a feeling of being conscious but unable to move. It occurs when a person passes between stages of wakefulness and sleep. During the transitions, you may be unable to move or speak for a few seconds up to a few minutes. Some people may also feel pressure or the sense of choking. Sleep paralysis may accompany other sleep disorders such as narcolepsy. Narcolepsy is an overwhelming need to sleep caused by problems with the brain's ability to regulate. I had a supervisor in Oklahoma who tried to do too much during the day when he was working nights, and he was an older guy, and he would literally fall asleep mid-sentence. So I used to...
Wow.
His wife would want to go shopping, so he'd go with her during the day. I'm like, dude, you worked last night, you worked tonight, you worked tomorrow night, you need to sleep. So I accused him of having narcolepsy, and the two most common creatures on Earth to suffer from narcolepsy are humans and wiener dogs.
So I was wiener funny. Dogs? I had a wiener dog growing up, but I believe that.
So yeah, I got to the point where I'd just see him asleep somewhere, and be like, and when I saw him, I'd be like, humans and wiener dogs, man. Screw off, Frankum. Narcolepsy is an overpowering need to sleep caused by it comes from the brain's ability to regulate sleep. Sleep paralysis occurs at one of two times. If it occurs while you're falling asleep, it's called hypnagogic or predormital sleep paralysis. If it happens as you're waking up, it's called hypnopompic or postdormital sleep paralysis. Hypnagogic. As you fall asleep, your body slowly relaxes. Usually, you become less aware, so you do not notice the change. However, if you remain or become aware while falling asleep, you may notice you cannot move or speak. During sleep, your body alternates between... Oh, this is hypnopompic. During sleep, your body alternates between REM, rapid eye movement, and NREM. What does NREM stand for, Chris?
I have no idea.
Non-rapid eye movement. Good job. sleep. One cycle of REM and NREM lasts about 90 minutes. During NREM sleep occurs first and takes up to 75% of your overall sleep time. During NREM sleep, your body relaxes and restores itself. At the end of NREM sleep, your sleep shifts to REM, rapid eye movement. Your eyes move quickly, hence the name, and dreams occur. I had a really strange dream last night, but I'm not going to go into it here because it was really friggin' strange.
That's called teasing.
That's called, I'm not willing to put this out to the public because the guys in white coats will come get me.
Again?
Teasing. But the rest of your body remains very relaxed. Your muscles are turned off during REM sleep. If you become aware before the REM cycle has finished, you may notice that you cannot move or speak. Causes. Up to as many as 4 out of 10, so 40% of people may have sleep paralysis. The common condition is often noticed in the teen years, but men and women of any age can have it. Sleep paralysis may run in families. Other factors may be linked to sleep paralysis include lack of sleep, sleep schedule that changes, mental conditions such as stress or bipolar disorder, and this one kind of sleeping on your back. If you're a back sleeper, apparently this is more common to happen. Other sleep problems such as narcolepsy and nighttime leg cramps, use of certain medications such as those for ADHD, and then substance abuse. So how do you diagnose this, Chris?
Pretty easily, actually.
Yeah. You wake up, you can't move, you got it.
Yep. So if you find yourself unable to move or speak in a few or move or speak for a few seconds or minutes when falling asleep or waking up, then it's likely that you have isolated recurrent sleep paralysis. Often there is no need to treat this condition, though. So check with your doctor if you have any of these concerns. You feel anxious about your symptoms. Your symptoms leave you very tired during the day. Your symptoms keep you up during the night. Your doctor may want to gather more information about your sleep health by doing any of the following. Might ask you to describe your symptoms and keep a sleep diary for a few weeks. Discuss your health history, including any known sleep disorders or a family history of such. Refer you to a sleep specialist for further evaluation. Conduct overnight sleep studies or daytime nap studies to make sure you do not have another sleep disorder. So how is it treated?
Real quick, Chris, you're a boss at my work, or you're one of the bosses.
Yeah.
Can I do daytime nap studies on post?
Absolutely.
How's it treated?
Yeah, sorry. No, so how is sleep
speaking
paralysis
of narcolepsy
treated? So most people need no treatment for sleep paralysis. Treating any underlying condition such as narcolepsy may help if you are anxious or unable to sleep well, but these treatments may include the following: improving your sleep habits, such as making sure you get 6 to 8 hours of sleep each night. Using an antidepressant medication if it is prescribed to help regulate sleep cycles. Treating any mental health problems that may contribute to your sleep paralysis. Treating any other sleep disorders such as narcolepsy or leg cramps. Do what you can to relieve stress in your life, especially just before bedtime. Try new sleep positions if you sleep on your back, and be sure to see your doctor if sleep paralysis routinely prevents you from getting a good night's sleep.
Yeah. So there we go.
Boom.
Paralysis.
In two episodes.
And literally I was going down the rabbit hole. I could have added another hour and we could have made this a triple, but I figured two was probably enough for now.
You know how there's Netflix and chill?
Uh-huh.
Netflix and chill being a euphemism for doing it.
Boning.
Yeah. So now that Disney Plus is out.
Oh, Jesus.
Disney Plus and Thrust.
Oh, wow. One thing I was going to mention is that one of the treatments that are most commonly prescribed for sleep paralysis is acupuncture.
And toast.
I got to tell you, posting that on your Facebook was much more satisfying than what I posted on Spencer's Facebook.
It kicked it off well, and I kind of figured when you didn't join in the post discussion that that's exactly what that was for. That was a firecracker in a library and walk away. That's what that was. Oh, no,
that was a firecracker in a library and sit outside on the bench across the street and watch everything happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I have in sleep paralysis.
That's what I have.
That's what I have on any paralysis for now. Excuse me.
Right.
I hope everybody has enjoyed these two episodes.
They're fun to do.
Please continue listening. Please continue listening. Yeah, if you would like to get a hold of us, please do. We've gotten a lot of emails just recently with ideas. We've got a whole bunch of really cool stuff kind of lined up. If you want to get a hold of us, you can get a hold of us on Twitter at MedSideStuff, MedSideStuff. You can get a hold of us on Instagram at MedicalStuff52. And then you can also get a hold of us at MedicalStuff on Facebook.
If you'd like to send us an email, please do. And you can do that at MedSideStuff@yahoo.com.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you feel comfortable giving us a 5-star review, please do. The more 5-star reviews we get, the more it moves us up on lists, and then we get more people to listen. So
yeah, we do.
Have a great week. We will talk to you soon, and toast.